We each have an awakened awareness that coexists with our regular awareness, you could say. It's a kind of intelligence that lives in us. And it recognizes the eternal truths. That's why the words of the Buddha and many of the words of the great, great teachers who lived thousands of years ago are celebrated today, because they remain alive in us. We recognize them effortlessly. It's our own awakened awareness that recognizes the truth. And to whatever degree that is predominating your awareness, that is the exact degree to which you recognize truth. And in fact, the world is always transmitting elements of the truth. Every circumstance of your life can be the inspiration for insight or the reminder of awakened awareness. So no matter what is happening in your life, and let's face it, it's a minefield. You know, you're walking along, everything's fine, and it's bam, out of the blue. Something happens, a loss. Many, many losses in this life. Little ones, great ones. Your body starts changing, kind of falling apart. A friend dies, a relative dies. You see something terrible on the news. It's pretty constant. What does awakened awareness do with that when it happens? What does awakened awareness do with loss and adversity? Now, some people, I would say in non-awakened awareness, create stories. They start telling stories, like magical thinking, fairy tales, about the meaning of things and the purpose, and it's all for a higher good, and it's this and it's that. That's one strategy. Some people go directly into denial. Another aspect of unawakened awareness, denial, avoidance, shove it away, be numb, find some way to get out of your mind, dull it out. But what does awakened awareness do with loss, with adversity, with the travails of life? It expands and includes it. It gets bigger. And it holds it. It holds it completely intimately, and it lets it hurt. That's what awakened awareness does with loss and adversity. And it forces a greater vastness of the awareness itself. It forces you into the biggest place of your being. And just when you think that you cannot be stretched another inch, you can't hold another inch of loss or adversity or sorrow or watching the news, you're called upon to do so. And in awakened awareness, you do. You don't turn away. You don't have fairy tale stories about what it all means. You expand and include it. And paradoxically, the more intense the loss or the adversity, which in a way has a kind of loudness in your being, it has a kind of roar in your being, the expansion that starts happening is quieter and quieter and quieter. So the quiet expansion is including the roar. It's almost the way, if you could imagine, the cataclysm of the eruption of planets. But it's happening in deep space. So there's this roar of an eruption happening in very deep, deep, profound, infinite space. And that is a kind of metaphor for the deep silence of awakened awareness that sits and lets whatever is happening keep opening it up without story, without denial, without strategy. It's not for the faint of heart. It's for the great courageous of heart, awakened awareness. That's why people avoid it mostly. So if you have any questions, anything you'd like to discuss on this matter, please feel free.
Some time ago, and maybe this is just common knowledge, and I'm not aware of it, and I'd heard it first from you, but you had talked about how Sufis are the ones with the cracked hearts. And I remember the first time I heard that.
Broken hearted. Somebody asked Rumi, what is a Sufi? And he said, a Sufi is one whose heart is broken.
And by that, I'm sure he didn't mean that one walks around in a depressed state.
No, moping around, no.
What does that mean? I mean, you've just explained, you know, what it is to be, to experience devastating loss in the midst of something that's greater and deeper.
That's right.
So this cracked heart, how does that look in a life, to walk around with a cracked heart? I mean, it doesn't mean that one is depressed.
No, Leonard Cohen has a great line in which he says, there's a crack in everything, that's how the light gets in, you know. No, it doesn't mean depression, of course. But it doesn't deny the sadness of loss. You know, I've reflected a lot in recent weeks about the nature of bonding as humans. My beloved brother died 3 weeks ago. There's an inevitable bonding that we all have as humans, you know. And I think so much of our spiritual misunderstanding has been to avoid that bonding and to detach from that kind of bonding and to, in a way, deny it and escape. And it's just so clear that if you're really deeply honest, it's just not possible, you know, that we are inevitably intertwined, interlinked. We love these forms. We love, you know, all the little crazy little peccadilloes of the forms, and that is becoming more and more beautiful to me, and seems a true celebration of actual spirit in life. And when we're ripped apart from these forms that we love, when in an instant, gone forever, there's an unequivocal sadness that happens with that. And yet, you know, it's like Isa, the great Zen poet, said, standing at the grave of his 13-year-old daughter who just died, he said, this dewdrop world is indeed a dewdrop world, and yet, you know, it is a dewdrop world. It is just a fleeting, it's a star at dawn, like the Buddha said. It's a flickering, you know, shooting star, this life. And yet, we're so here and we're so in love with it if we tell the truth. And that's as it should be. There's no need to deny that. And there's no need to not let it rip open our hearts over and over again.
Maybe what it is just a willingness to be tender, you know, to,
yes,
to allow
yes,
your
yes.
heart to be
and
broken.
And as I was saying, being tender is for only the courageous of heart. People think, mistakenly, they think it's the opposite, that being strong and being tough and being whatever. But actually, that's just being armored. Being tender, letting it fill you up and make your being have to expand to include it. That's something. That's something else. And it does this because the habit of awakened awareness is strong. You know, it's so easy to see how a mind in the face of loss can slip into, first of all, some sort of bargaining or some sort of negotiation with the universe, or into denial. You know, into just don't want to go there. Let's think about something else.
Well, there are probably phases that anyone goes
yes,
through.
Yes, of course.
And even wanting to be wide awake, I'm sure there are phases of
yes,
breathing.
Yes, yes, exactly. There definitely are. But my point is that in the awareness that I'm speaking of, it's like a gigantic spotlight is on, you know, the subject. And there is no place to hide. So the only thing you can do, you know, the options are madness or awakened perspective, basically. It becomes a very simple choice.
It seems the stiller you become, you almost, for me it's like kneeling before a chopping block and just allowing your head to be cut, almost, you know, just allowing yourself to be opened, to just be. I mean, that's a hard image, but just allowing yourself to be taken with however life is going.
Yeah. Yes, as I'm saying, it's more a sense of expansion. That's what it feels like. It feels that, like, your being can contain it. It can contain it.
When I've experienced loss in my life, I'm going through a period of it now as well, and I don't have any sense of expansion at all, and I struggle much more with this feeling of sinking. Sinking into, like, just like
into
immobility.
A black hole,
yeah,
yes.
The black hole. And I don't know how to work with that. Mm-hmm. I can't see, and I can't.
And what is the nature of the loss in relationship?
It's not relationship, it's more. I just moved to Los Angeles. Like 2 weeks ago,
oh,
and so it's
from,
my whole...
From where?
From Oakland.
From Oakland.
Yeah. And, you know, it's my community, my friends, my
yes.
life, my business, everything
yes,
just
yes.
gone.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, I don't know how to work with that.
Mm-hmm. So as I'm saying, there's an aspect of your awareness, in fact, that is perfectly fine. There's an aspect of your awareness that is perfectly fine and quite vast right now. Is it not so? Just now.
Right now, yeah.
Yeah.
But then I'll sink.
Well, let's not go into the future, because you don't know.
It's true.
But to recognize this aspect, that even though those things are true, there's a loss. You've left a community. You've left a number of things that you loved. And so there is loss. Let's not deny that. There's a feeling of loss, and that will arise as thoughts and feelings and emotions. Okay? But there is an aspect right now, even if those thoughts are rolling through, that is completely fine and vast. Isn't it? Like, almost like I said, deep space. So if you think of a gigantic sky, limitless sky, and you think of these trails of thoughts and losses and emotions and feelings coming through the sky, right? You can, in awakened awareness, the awareness will be primarily on the sky, even though it's not denying or avoiding the thoughts and the emotions and the feelings that come through. In fact, it notices them more than ever because they're coming through in a very clear space. They're showing up in a very vast space, so they're easily defined. The sinking feeling has to do with chasing the thoughts, has to do with following the sad thought and adding more sad thoughts to it, and then going into the future with the sad thoughts and maybe adding a whole regret element. And that starts to create this heavy sinking feeling because these emotions take over the body and feed on each other in a way. But it's quite possible to directly experience these sad thoughts and truly welcome them, but not be compelled by them or obsessed by them. And then you're just floating in this vast sky-like freedom. And then, whether in Los Angeles or Calcutta, the taste of it is the taste of freedom. You see, it's portable. Wherever you go, you can be experiencing this sky-like nature. And it's amazing how you can just shift into it, how the awareness will just go into it as it becomes more the habit. No strategy to get rid of the feelings that are associated with loss. No strategy whatsoever. But to let the feelings exist in the true context of them, which is open space. Awareness that is not touched, is not dampened, is not diminished, that is perfectly fine as you're experiencing it right now. So what happens in a context like this is you sort of drench in this awakened awareness, you get soaked to the bone. And it becomes a reference for you, becomes a reference point.
In experiencing the loss of someone that has died, do you ever, is there a knowing or a feeling that there's something in that person that doesn't die or hasn't died?
What I would say, in my experience, not just with my brother, but in general, is that I do sense and I pay attention to what we could call the universal force or the breath of existence, right? There's something we cannot measure. We're so far from understanding the mysterious quality that is blazing all of this, right? That is blazing you and me, and blazes everything, even things that we call inanimate. That is clearly going on. We could call it even eternal, right? That goes on and on and on and on. That which blazed my brother is blazing still, but I definitely don't sense it blazing my brother anymore. No.
Not the individual.
No, I don't sense that at all. But I don't know. I just don't sense it, and I don't have a belief system that says that that's so. As comforting as it would be to be communing with my brother right now, to be continuing our nightly talks, as lovely as that would be, and I can certainly see people's desperate need to believe that, I can definitely understand that. But I don't have that comfort. What I do have in this regard is this sense of connecting to the eternal presence that blazed him and blazes me and blazes everything. And, you know, it's like Punjaji said, the wise are attracted by the eternal while the foolish pursue the transient and are thus bludgeoned by time. So anytime we're clutching onto the transient, you know, anytime we're just fixated on the transient, we will be bludgeoned by time. It's inevitable. And it's just part of being human as well. So there's always this fine balance of, like I said, letting it break your heart, don't deny it, don't avoid it, don't tell big stories. Or if you're telling stories that you believe, and you have fairy tales you believe, well and good, lucky you. But for myself, it's this starkness. It's very stark, and it's very powerful, and it forces the awareness into a larger space than I had imagined. Just to contain it, just to hold it, just to keep breathing. You know. Then what happens is, you know, in Dharma dialogues, in retreats. I don't know if you were at one retreat when we did this, but we sometimes do this exercise, an interactive silent exercise called seeing God with God's eyes, where two people sit opposite each other from the retreat, preferably people who don't know each other. And we do with three different partners this little exercise. And they sit opposite each other for 3 minutes and without touching or speaking, simply look into each other's eyes for 3 minutes. Then they bow to this partner, they get up, and they take a new partner. And we do it 3 times. And it is amazing what happens in that short amount of that little span of time, what happens to people, what insights come from that very simple engagement. One of the more fascinating, consistent insights that I've heard, you know, cross-culturally, having done this many different retreats, is a feeling of the people tune into what they might call the presence or the light that seems to be in everyone. And they start seeing that in each pair of eyes. And it becomes, in a way, strangely impersonal. They start seeing beyond the personal of the form, and they're seeing kind of the same light in each set of eyes. And there's a way in which a kind of awareness comes whereby you start sensing that presence or that light in everything, you know. And that even, like, even the wood on the floor, and, you know, and you start sensing that, and that becomes, you know, that becomes what you're seeing, what you're experiencing. So then the forms, you know, have their own beauty and have their own delight, and you have special connections to certain of the forms. But there can be this undercurrent of this mysterious presence that is informing you and everything else. And the more you feel it in yourself, the more you start seeing it. And this is the mystical view. This is exactly the mystical. This is what the great mystic poets are talking about. And as I often remind us, they weren't writing poetry. They were describing reality. It just sounds like poetry. But when you're in this, it sounds like music to your ears when people speak from that. It sounds like poetry. And in fact, it's literal descriptions of a perspective on reality. It's like reporting. I said in my book, it's reporting from the field of awakened awareness. It's a reportage.
Several years ago, I lost both of my parents, but I've...
At once, or...?
A year apart.
A year apart.
And I'm amazed and not amazed, because I've always felt this, that feelings don't come forth about this. You know? I've never grieved. I have, but when I look at what that's all about, I could see the possibility of more grieving. It's never occurred. And also just in daily life, I feel connected. I feel in a strange place where I feel really connected to things and I feel not connected enough. I feel like I've somehow I'm creating space between myself and perhaps, you know, all of it. Because I was going to say beauty. But the whole range.
Yeah, beauty to horror.
Yeah, I just sense that there's some kind of tempering that goes on in this life I'm experiencing.
Mm-hmm.
So... Well, I'm kind of resisting that.
Yeah.
I don't like that. Mm-hmm. I don't know what to do about this. Is there anything to do about it?
Well, I think that your recognition of it is enough. And if there is a sense of a kind of a numbing in a way that you're describing, or a kind of buffering, a distancing, and with this awareness that I'm speaking about, you will notice the cost of that. And what is the cost of this buffering? What it is it doesn't give you the full expanse of joy and of connectedness, as you say. And these are some of the rich, the most extraordinary tastes of this life, but they come with tremendous risk. And exactly what I am saying here tonight, people avoid feeling deeply in all kinds of ways. Much of what's going on out there is an avoidance of feeling deeply. There's numerous systems of thought that kind of keep you buffered, right? And then there's all kinds of psychological strategies. And then there's just plain old distractions, you know, the usuals, you know, entertainment, sex, you know, whatever. Anything you can find, anything that gets you through the night, drugs, whatever. You know, these are all attempts to not be this kind of lion-hearted creature that feels everything, right? That feels everything really deeply and profoundly. But I said last weekend in San Diego, there's a quote I love from a philosopher, I can't remember his name at the moment, but he said, would you rather be... a pig contented or Socrates discontented? Or would you rather be a fool? He also said, would you rather be a fool contented or Socrates discontented? Well, when you think about what that actually implies, when you think about the intelligence and the sensitivity that a being like Socrates represents, and the range of human experience that he's experiencing, right? Just bring it on, right? Let's go. Let's see what this is here. It's pretty thrilling. You know, it's pretty amazing. I mean, he showed up. And he tasted this. He sampled what was here, even though a lot of what he saw was pretty hard, and he had a kind of not so great ending. But nevertheless, you know, I would have rather been Socrates than a contented pig.
Me too.
Yeah. So, you know, the point is we don't have to be even a discontented creature. We can be an enlivened, fully awake creature, willing to experience what's here with all of it. You know, the joys and the sorrows, because you don't get to have one without the other. And if that is your heart's calling, actually, just your recognition that knows when you're buffering is enough. Because it'll start to wear it down. The recognition itself, the awareness itself will start to wear it down. And you'll begin, without even planning, without intention in a way, making experiments whereby you're a little bit more vulnerable and you let in someone just a little bit more than you might have. And, you know, and you might get burned. And then you see, that burned, but something grew out of the ashes. You know, something blossomed. There's another fantastic Rumi line, which he says, "In the driest, whitest stretch of pain's infinite desert, I lost my sanity and found this rose." So the sanity of, you know, the playing it safe, yeah. Sanity. So I recommend, you know, I for many years, as you know, I was in a practice that sought to detach from the world, from worldliness, from feeling, from suffering, from all kinds of things, from bonding. That was the spiritual program, and that is a lot of the spiritual programs. And I am saying the complete opposite now. I say, let it be as passionate as it actually is, because this is really amazing what's happening here. You know, being alive for this blink in eternity, you know, just being here and experiencing this, you know, every day, just so precious, every minute so precious. And we forget and we, you know, we dull out and we take it all for granted and we think it's going to just, you know, go on. And that we've got time to fool around and screw around and be unconscious and all of that. But there comes a point in your own awakened awareness where you start to get the picture really clearly, you know, and you start to realize how truly precious this is, how much gratitude you inevitably feel, and you can't help but weep in the face of it.
Thank you.
Hi.
Hi.
Socrates and the pig. Do you think it's possible to become a contented Socrates?
Well, I think that it's possible. I think that it's possible to have the kind of awakened awareness that I suspect he had and be contented in your own particular case. I can't say what the nature of his own mind was, but I think that it is very possible and very, in fact, likely in awakened awareness to have a certain degree of contentment despite everything, despite all the minefield that we're walking through.
Minefield or mind?
Mine, M-I-N-E, the minefield, yeah. You know, it's one of my Buddhist friends used the example of, you know, you're linked arm in arm with your pals, and you're walking across a minefield, and every now and again a mine goes off, and there goes, you know, one of your relatives, and there goes one of your friends, and there goes your kid, and, you know, I mean, there's an element to life where that's just the truth, you know.
So it seems that this journey to this kind of awareness, with me anyway, is through incredible pain. And then you allow the pain for so long, and then with me personally, there's a lot of tears.
Yes.
And at the bottom of it, there's this, I wouldn't say it's joy,
there's this,
but
this rose on the driest, whitest stretch of pain.
There's peacefulness.
Yes,
there's a peace
indeed.
There,
and it's there throughout. It's there throughout all of the intensity of the pain, because I don't want to indicate here that you can only get to awakened awareness through pain. I'm not saying that at all. Awakened awareness pre-exists. You can experience pain through awakened awareness, just as you're experiencing joy through awakened awareness. The more awake the awareness, the more intensely it will experience pain and joy. But as I've been saying, it has the capacity to hold it all easily. It's so huge, it's so vast, it keeps expanding. It's like, it's the nature of love, really. It's the way that love doesn't look away, you know.
But can they exist at the same time?
Yes.
Can we be aware of the pain and the pleasure at the same time?
Yeah, well, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's
even
the
though,
trick,
even
I guess,
though
isn't
on
it?
A momentary basis, let's say, the flicker of a thought, you know. Let's use this metaphor. There's this open expanse of awareness that is your predominant habit. Now, through the awareness, all kinds of things are happening. There's lots of flickers of things, of thoughts and feelings and sights and sounds and smells and so on. And in any given microsecond, the awareness might flick onto a thought, you know, and be interested for a moment. And it might be a sad thought. But here's another sky-like metaphor. When you know the sun is in the sky, which we know, generally speaking, even though it's cloudy, there may be a thunderstorm, it may be that you're in a place that rains a lot and you've got a low fog cover for several months, as we used to have in Portland, when one would sometimes suspect that there is no sun. But actually, you know, in truth, the sun is shining. There's something that is unspoken in your being that knows that there is a sun shining in the sky. And in the same way, in awakened awareness, you know for sure, whatever is happening, it's just passing phenomena. It's not actually going to define or collapse the awareness. Even though it's very, very sad in the case of intense loss, you know, or in the case of intense joy, you know that it's extremely exhilarating, and you know that too is passing through the sky.
Is there a practice that you would recommend at all?
No, it's a recognition of this already existing awareness through which you're effortlessly hearing these concepts and words, and you're grokking them with this awareness because it's familiar. So you don't have to go anywhere to get it or practice anything to achieve it. You only have to recognize it and be willing to inhabit the largesse of space that it demands. Hi.
Hi.
Cal.
I want to know about the discontented pig.
Yes, you want to know about that?
Well, and I was thinking about the, you know, the hedonist, the eat, drink, and be merry, and I was wondering what was wrong with that. And I was just...
No, there's a lot right with that. You know, the whole sort of Zorba the Greek kind of, you know, response. If it's truly a celebration, if it's truly a great celebration, there comes a point where, you know, somebody was telling me that they were talking to Ramesh Bhasikar, and they were saying to him, well, what do you like to do kind of on your time off when you're not having satsang? And he said, well, I like to get together with my friends and sing bhajans, basically sing hymns to God. And so sure enough, this particular friend went over there one evening, and he went into his apartment, and there he was with a group of his old friends, all these old people, sitting around singing hymns to God. You know, I thought that was a very beautiful story. You know, that there comes a point when there's really not much to say, and you don't need to sit around and discuss philosophy. You celebrate together in whatever ways that makes sense. But often when people are talking about eat, drink, and making merry, it doesn't really look like that much fun. They look like they're just trying to go unconscious.
So that's what I was thinking, is that if there is this knowing, and it's about recognizing life, then is there a value judgment being placed on, say, the story, the explanation that you gave to us at the beginning about what expanded awareness is versus other fairy tales, as long as that knowing is there?
I'm not quite sure I'm following your question.
Is there a difference between, say, the explanation of that expanded awareness?
Well, the expanded awareness I'm speaking about is a direct experience that you actually are familiar with already.
I'm just wondering what the fairy tales are, because what I've seen is a lot of different models for understanding what life is.
Yes.
Different belief systems.
Yes.
And yet there seems to be a knowing in all of them. And they're different. And I'm just wondering, somebody mentioned reincarnation, and you were talking about Punjaji believed in reincarnation, and I guess that's their belief system, and the knowing that we might share may be indifferent to what the belief system behind it is, or perhaps even cross-cultural on very deep levels or many different levels.
Right.
And
from this vantage point, the knowing is in saying this is a mystery that we can know. It's very mysterious. I get, personally, I don't find much use in belief systems because I don't have those beliefs. They're very comforting, definitely. And if one has them, they're extremely comforting. And I used to have a strong belief system in karma and rebirth and everything being lawful and just over spanning time, you know, in different lifetimes and so on. And, you know, I had that for many years, that belief system, and it fell away a long time ago in the face of the fact that I did not know. It just seemed like a good thing to believe, but I did not know. And when I really, you know, tell the truth, I have to stay with exactly what I can say is my own experience, which isn't, you know, I don't know much. But I find I'm more comfortable with people who say that. I trust them more. Not that I think somebody else is deliberately trying to deceive me, but because I think they're in some ways deluded or psychologically having a problem that they need to clutch onto something they don't really know, and they present as a belief that they think that they'll say is true.
It feels as if sometimes when we are just speaking with each other, that just the points of engagement are all that really matter.
Yes. Yes. I would agree that showing up here and sharing love is really all that really matters. And really showing up, really experiencing this passionate engagement of life. And that, you know, you don't really need to know much to have that experience. You really don't need to know. You don't have to have a philosophy. You don't have to have a spiritual tradition. You know?
Thank you.
You're welcome. I've been feeling for a long time a kind of deconstruction that is happening in my own way of sharing. I feel that I'm constantly up against sort of spiritual conceptions that are very conditioning. And of course, this context attracts people who love the Dharma and also people who have a lot of spiritual beliefs and conditioning. So it stays, you know, kind of lively in that regard. But I feel that a lot of what I'm you know, saying is a kind of a peeling away of the veils of belief. You know, really just peeling them away and just saying, okay, do you really know this, or is it something you've been hearing for a long time? And perhaps from people you trust. I mean, I look at the people who were my teachers, my early teachers, and I see that those were very well-intentioned, respectable people. They were not, you know, charlatans trying to get anybody's money, you know. They were good people. But I began to realize they're speaking about things they don't actually experience. They're reading from these old dusty texts. And who wrote those, you know? And so you begin to start, you know, you start to see the truth is a lot of our spiritual beliefs have come from people whose lifespan was, you know, in their late 20s or 30s, really, who moved in a radius of space that was smaller than our zip codes, you know, who thought that the world was flat, who had no idea that bacteria was connected to disease, who, you know, believed in all kinds of superstitions. I mean, these are the basis for what we now have as religion. These are the communities out of what religion came. There are a lot of very tribal people who lived short, brutal lives and who did not have the benefit of cross-cultural education or any other ideas that might influence their way of seeing. And these tribal beliefs became the big religions. They kind of grew.
And yet maybe just what they had is a sense of knowing that they wanted to share. And that was just how they expressed it.
Yes. Of course, there was an impetus. There was an impetus to connect and to make sense of the world. And it was an evolutionary development that was necessary. But I'm saying at this point in time, we have the benefit of an entire world of education and of social discourse and of cross-cultural seeding of ideas and experimentation and science. And I mean, we have the best educational tools available ever in history. And we can look at all of this we can take from some of these great traditions the understandings of the pure awareness, which some of them did have. And we can apply that, you know, with all of this other extraordinary treasure of knowledge. And when we do that, we come up with, hey, this is an amazing mystery. You know, this is an incredible mystery. And there's just a few things we actually need to know for real happiness. And we've been speaking about those few things tonight. Okay, so we'll sit together for just a few minutes in silence to close and just to relax in beingness, doing nothing, but enjoying our company in this beautiful presence. Thank you.